It would have been nicer if I had said that is the point of consciousness in man. A point within a five-pointed star. The five-pointed star is the star of mankind, but it's the star of hierarchy. And the point within the center is our consciousness. And the tips of the star could be seen as the input of the five senses. However you like, you must formulate these. When you've got your own group, you have your own symbols and things. But when you look at that, then you can understand why people like me and Marcus and others here almost weep when we read, when we hear quoted these wonderful words of John Spencer Muirhead. He talks about the point of consciousness, or if you like, if you're a theosophist, a spark of the flame divine, if you're reading The Voice of the Silence, which you should all have on your shelves, or if you like to see it as the inner self caught up in the web of intrigue, which is material substance, let us consider his words. There is a flame within me that has stood unmoved, untroubled through a mist of years, knowing nor love nor laughter, hope nor fears, nor foolish throb of ill, nor wine of good. I feel no shadow of the winds that brood. I hear no whisper of a tide that veers. I weave no thought of passion nor of tears. Unfettered I of time, of habitude. I know no birth, I know no death that chills. I fear no fate nor fashion, cause nor creed. I shall outdream the slumber of the hills. I am the bud, the flower, I the seed. For I do know that in whate'er I see, I am the part, and it is the soul of me. Now you know why the literature of ancient wisdom is so clear, how it points to an undisturbed center, a center within the cyclone of upheaval in this world, the stress, the cyclone of stress, the pain and the suffering, and the kids in Bangladesh, and the families on the mountains of Iraq, and the awful hunger of Africa. So much so that we're flicking the television all the time. We can't watch it. And then, without any relief, it's the destruction of the animal kingdom. So that life, if you are at all sensitive, is a very cruel thing for most of us, for most of the time. And if you haven't got that center, that flame divine within you, that you can return to, even if you are some distance from it and can just pick up a little of its warmth and its color, you are nothing. You are nothing. And out there in the world, you may think that your neighbor or somebody else, one of the Joneses, has got a lot more than you. Not at all. You have exactly the same as they have, but they don't know it. And that is a flame divine within you, a part of the inner reality. So now we have the element of Maya. At least I would need to do five lectures to do it properly, and I'm not even thinking of going any further on the subject of Maya. But taking this matter up from where I left off, the next thing that you would want to know is, how do you deal with this coiled serpent, this viper at your breasts? How do you deal with it? It's there all day long. You know you feel better if you've got a bigger bank balance. You can't help it. You've been grown up that way. And because you've got a bigger bank balance than yesterday, you can be a bit more cocky today. That's how it is. It's a viper. And you have to be able to deal with it. Well, the ancients knew this. They knew it. And so they devised a method whereby they were able to handle this matter better, and they were able to downgrade the value of the material world. So two ways, how to handle the situation of materialism and how to degrade it. And you know, it is a terrible problem. It's a terrible problem. This extraordinary fact that the material world seems to crush everything out of us. Its demands, it gets first, very like the church, very like the church. They get the child when it's, almost when it's born, about the time it's christened, and they have it until it's 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years of age. They have first choice on that child. They get the child and they can pump into it what they like. And despite the fact that they have all those opportunities to do it, attendance at church is just dropping all the time. What's it now? 3%? I think it's a disgrace. These devils, these materialists who use this situation, which is a deception, to entrench themselves. We call them spiritually sick. The materialists who use this to entrench themselves and grab in the world, we call them the spiritually sick. A poem, Ozymandias, which I'm sure you've heard me quote many times. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand out in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. 2,500 years ago, this monstrosity in stone stood there, glaring at the world, daring anybody to challenge him. Now it's just lying in dust on the desert sand. Ozymandias. If you want to find the real, really great desert of materialism, you want to try Texas. They have big banks in Texas, as you would expect. I did a lot of traveling over there, touring, lecturing, talking about these subjects. And I was driving into Fort Worth one day. And as I drove in, Fort Worth was in the distance. But on the next hill, there was a huge billboard. And on the billboard, there was a picture of a bank. And another 2 miles away, 3 miles, was the biggest bank you ever saw in your life in reality. It was in Fort Worth. And so as you drove past this billboard, you looked at it and it said, that's my bank. That's my bank. And as you drove past it, you saw the bank itself. And you said to yourself, well, what was that all about? And then you think back and you see, It said, "That's my bank," and then on the next slide it said, "Sure." And right in front of you is the bank that that picture referred to. Well, for those of you who want a little bit of delight, that bank no longer exists. It went broke. Not so sure. Makes you think of Lloyd's of London, touchy subject at the moment, facing, what's it, 2 billion, 3 billion payout for the last few years. We could have told them. Saturn conjunct heavy planets in Capricorn means lots of trouble and lots of pain and suffering. Perhaps one day they could spare £1 million just to look into the subject of astrology. Lloyd's, yes. But Lloyd's has a very high rating in America. The Americans love Lloyd's and they insure with Lloyd's because Lloyd's was the only bank in the world that paid out after the San Francisco earthquake. Even in those days, it was £6 billion and Lloyd's paid out every penny. I always tell the Americans that. They hate it. Nothing is sure. Nothing is sure at all. Who are the spiritually sick? Are they just the materialists? And what is their medicine? According to Madame Blavatsky, the spiritually sick are the materialists, and the way that you cure them is to make them suffer. Earthquakes, famine, ships, liners overturning, burning. Who remembers the Morro Castle? Ship that blazed for weeks, at least a liner off the coast of America in the mid-30s, 1930s. And so, according to Blavatsky, these people will never learn unless they suffer. And the only way they'll suffer is to see what they love best taken away from them. And she was quite emphatic about it. She said, "Suffering is heaven's merciful medicine for the spiritually sick. How else will you distract the materialists from their obsession with material wealth than to make them suffer?" The moment they suffer, they say, "Why couldn't I protect myself from the suffering? Who has let me down? An insurance company, an agent, an advisor, who's let me down? I'll sack him." They've suffered and they don't like it because it's the only thing that money and wealth can save them from. The Maharishi said of suffering, "Suffering turns men towards their creator." Now we've all suffered, had my share, I'm sure you've had yours. And it may not be very obvious, but it does. It helps to turn us towards the inner reality. You say to yourself, that out there is nothing but suffering. I'm not going back into it. Where will I go then? I'll go to the other direction, the opposite pole, which is the inner reality. Suffering sends people, of course, scuttling to the churches. Scuttling. The churches are full when death and destruction hits the material world. And the basis of the suffering is attachment. Attachment. If you love something emotionally, dearly, above all other things, you're attached to it. In the astral world, there is an astral cord between you and what you desire most. In the world, the astral, the lower worlds where perverts exist, you can see these perverts joined to the objects, joined literally in astral material, joined to the objects of their desire. And so that's the thing to remember with material things, that it's an attachment, something you're attached to. And if you can't break it, you're not going to get away and tread the path. There's no reason why you should not have wealth, that you should not have everything available on the earth, provided you understand that it's not yours. It belongs to the planet, and it will change hands 1,000 times. It is yours only so long as you will share it with humanity in some way. That's the basis of attachment. How do the teachers of ancient wisdom combat this constant lurch towards materialism? And the answer is that they do it through a variety of processes, but the forerunner of which is known as asceticism, asceticism or asceticism. Just as you say that somebody, anybody, will have been a communist at some time or the other in his life, and that was true of me immediately after the last war. So too we say that everybody treading the path sooner or later wants to be an ascetic. He rarely gets so browned off at some stage of his life with materialism that he wants to get away from it all, sack everybody in the household, get away from it all, and just be himself and as least dependent upon his environment as possible. The ascetic. Mustn't get him mixed up with a stoic. The stoic is the person who likes to identify himself with nature and to copy nature at any price. Famous stoic was walking through parkland once, and he saw an animal, a deer, go down to the water pool and drink straight into its mouth. And forever after, he did the same, crouched down and drank water straight out of the... I didn't know that, but I thought it was Johnny Weissmuller that did that. Weissmuller, I suppose. The ascetics. But the great mistake about the ascetics is to think that being an ascetic takes you a step further to God. It's a device used to combat materialism. Many people don't need it, don't need that device. And it's important to remember. And so, in order to combat materialism, you lead a sort of ascetic life. You go into retreat. It's not easy to be an ascetic in this world. Very hard to live in both worlds at once. Very hard indeed. And what the ascetics do in their practices, the strict disciplines they undertake, the celibacy, the self-mortification through fasting, these things that they do are recognized as self-mortification, self-mortification, deadening the personality with its vehicles to this world, deadening to this world, stopping the world controlling any part of them. And if you think it's part of the divine plan, you're wrong. But it is a very, very helpful device. I think I told you once before how I met a group in the United States of America who were crazy about all these kinds of devices for processing their bodies. When I arrived there, they were busy eating sprouting wheat. It was growing on their shelves, on their sinks, on the laboratories, anywhere where it was possible they'd got wheat sprouting. And that was the ongoing thing. Not all the way towards asceticism, but quite a fair way. The next time I went in, they were crazy about bananas. And they wouldn't touch any bananas that hadn't been gassed. Sorry, it's the other way around. They wouldn't touch the gassed bananas. They would only have ungassed bananas because they were nearer to nature. The gassing was to kill the pests on them. And then it was enemas. Morning coffee wasn't complete without a rap session on what their enemas were doing for them. And they were enthusiastic about it, and it never stopped. But the much, much more important discipline of any of these, and the reason why the ascetics functioned at all, was the disciplining of the mind. And that discipline never had a chance with the good people I'm mentioning now. If you ask them whether they had had a good meditation that morning, you'd probably be told, no, but I had one hell of an enema. So this is the danger with praiseworthy things like hatha yoga, sitting for development, breathing exercises, calisthenics. They in themselves may become the gods instead of being steps towards achieving something else. It's easy to say, thy kingdom come, but it's very much harder to say, this kingdom go. Very much harder to say that. Deliberately dying to the little self is what we call self-mortification. Jesus said, I die daily. And he surely meant dying to all the things of this world, the separativeness of this world and the competitiveness of this world. I must tell you another story. And it's pertaining to the sin of divisiveness. I heard it pronounced on television the other night as divisiveness. Divisiveness. And the story is the woman and the carrot. There was once an old peasant. A peasant woman who was totally self-centered. She could never include anybody else in her affections except herself. Nor could she look beyond her own personal needs. Eventually the old lady died, and for her total selfishness, she was consigned to hell. Here in hell, she stayed for long ages, surrounded by people of her own ilk who never gave a damn for anybody or anything except their own miserable desires. After much wailing and beseeching for rescue from her circumstances, the Lord asked her what she wanted. She cried out, O Lord, whatever have I done wrong, I've paid for. I've paid for it 1,000 times. Please get me out of here. The Lord pondered a moment and answered her, because you once showed kindness to a poor beaten donkey and fed it with your last carrot, I'll help you just this once. Presently, the old lady saw a rope slithering down into hell with a carrot on the end of it. And she ran up to it And by that time, the carrot was dangling in front of her, and she grasped at it and held on hard. Slowly, the rope began to draw her upwards. Immediately, there was a rush by other inmates of hell towards it. The old woman tightened her grip on the rope, and she glared at the ruffians around her. And as they stretched up for the rope too, she lashed out at them, kicking them away. "Get away," she shouted. "This is my rope." Immediately the rope sagged, and the old lady fell to the ground, the rope beside her. She had denied others in her life yet once again. So it was that she had to spend many eons in the vault of hell, until she could learn the simple art of sharing. Sharing is the opposite of divisiveness. She saw the rope as her property. It's mine, and not the Lord's. The things that are on earth are the Lord's, and we borrow them for this incarnation. It is His will that we share them. Otherwise, we must consider that all property is theft. Only when we share what we have can we justify ownership. This is one of the meanings of total committal, asceticism. It's against those who keep up with the Joneses. The Joneses get a car, they get a bigger one. Joneses get a fridge, they get a wider one. So it goes on. The ego center, thinking and feeling and acting and pandering to the senses and appetites. Millions live like this, millions. There was an old ascetic called Diogenes. Everybody knows about Diogenes. There are many anecdotes about him. Perhaps the famous one was when he was paid a visit. Diogenes lived in a barrel, and there couldn't be much less inviting than a barrel to live in. And all around him were the dogs of the village, whom he fed with every piece of food that came his way, starving himself all the time. His fame spread, and one day Alexander the Great passed through the village, and he was taken at his request to see Diogenes. He appeared in front of the barrel and looked down at Diogenes and asked, "Is there anything I can do for you, Diogenes?" Diogenes replied, "Yes, move away. You're blocking my sunlight." Diogenes, who lived in a barrel. If any of you can find some more anecdotes on Diogenes, I'd be pleased if you would send them in to me. We're doing a set of books for children, and we're looking for esoteric stories related to children. Asceticism. It's meant to reduce the hegemony of the personality. It helps the unicorn defeat the lion. If you see my books, you see that I have three raging horses on which Mercury stands and attempts to guide them. And Mercury is the personality attempting to hold the three horses of the three bodies of the lower triad. Asceticism acts homeopathically at subtle levels. It is a remedy for the hard-hearted. If you have a person who's very cold, very hard-hearted, who's got Saturn afflicted in his horoscope, especially if it's in Leo, Saturn in Leo, hard-hearted. if you've got such a person, you prescribe some form of retreat or asceticism where he can suffer and not cause agony in others while he's suffering. And the result of this, that it ultimately invokes compassion, because if you have suffered something, you can say, I know what it's like, I've suffered that. And it helps to mellow, to make softer, more compassionate the person who is hard-hearted. Asceticism may be imposed by adversity. People have lived in a country that has been smitten by war, and when the war was over and the country had pulled itself out of its difficulties, there were those who still liked to live as ascetics. We still hear moans from the medical profession in this country about how healthy the people who lived in the war in England really were, because they didn't eat so much butter and cheese and eggs and other cholesterol materials. It can be also applied by reincarnation. You can be born into circumstances in which you are constantly withdrawn. You can be born into a family where the father is a tyrant, like Elizabeth Barrett Browning. You can be born into circumstances of poverty and isolation. And that would be under the laws of karma. And you would see this in the horoscope as well. Saturn in the fourth house or in Cancer. A family situation which is very, very hard to bear. Very hard to bear. The father is a tyrant or the mother is ill. Always ill. And so members of the family, usually the eldest daughter, is imposed upon by the mother who is ill, and she looks after the mother. Imposition of asceticism. Karma imposes it too. If you've exiled somebody to some far distant island and imposed hardship on that individual, where he is poorly fed, has no sort of company, has hard labor to perform, all the judges prescribing hard labor are candidates for an ascetic's life in the years ahead somewhere. Sickness can impose it as well. You're restricted as to what foods you can eat, heavily restricted by your sickness, by your condition, unable to go out in public and socialize. All will achieve the same result, and the result is disenchantment with things material. Disenchantment. So if you are interested in astrology and you see Saturn, look for Saturn for asceticism. If you see Saturn in the house of the family, then you can say, your family life makes you disenchanted with the world. You can go right round the zodiac doing that. Your teachers make you disenchanted with learning. You're disenchanted with money. Asceticism, Dharma, nature, poverty. These are factors which all of you must confront. Most of the successful treaders of the path have gone through periods of great neglect and poverty. Blavatsky gave her passage money when she went on board a ship to New York, to the New World. She had her passage money in a nasty little cabin somewhere. But she gave her passage money away to get a girl onto the ship who wanted to go to America, somebody she met on the wharf side. And so both of them had to go steerage in the open deck across the Atlantic. She suffered great neglect. In order to get the information for her secret doctrine, she had to travel all over the the wild parts of the earth, the Gobi Desert, the Himalayas, places like that, often on horseback, which is no easy thing for a plump woman with lots of books and things to carry. And you can go to Annie Besant, who had a frightful married life, and Alice Bailey, and so on. Now, the question is, do we have to give up everything for sake of rapid spiritual growth? The answer is yes, but there is an escape clause. The alternative way, as I said earlier, is to put everything that you have totally into the hands of those, including yourself, who work on the path. Whatever material possessions you have must ultimately work for the service of humanity. You may retain the title deeds of houses, of the property, so long as the purpose of the property is to further in some way the plan which the great ones have for the earth. You may continue to enjoy a high salary, the important position of, an important position, two cars perhaps, the large wardrobe, so long as retention of these things is honestly and clearly understood in your mind that they are for the highest and noblest purposes. This is part of the teaching of the noble truths. But you will say, well, what about my family? They've got to live. My obligations, surely there must be adequate provision for them. Certainly they must. We call this dharma, the necessity to discharge honorably your basic obligation. We don't walk around telling people to drop everything they're doing and leave loved ones and family in the lurch and so on. Do what has to it, but let go when your obligations are fulfilled. You can't expect to live by the dictates, suggestions of the world of inner reality and pick and choose. I found that out. As I said earlier, the mother who wants to have her daughter's babies for her is denying that daughter the good karma of having her babies herself instead of fussing her and using it as an excuse not to get involved in something more karmically worthy. Many young people come to me and ask, what are they to do? They love the esoteric work. They want to tread the path. They want to go the whole way. What do they do if they want to marry and have children? And my answer to them is always the same. If you want to go through with all that, what it entails, the nappies and goodness knows what, you want domestic life, if you really must do it, then do it. Do it and do it properly. The worst thing in the world that can happen is that you go off and you join an esoteric group. Time is spent on you to coach you, train you in esoteric matters. And then after 3 or 4 months, you fall for the first bit of skirt that walks by and you go off and you've let that group down. It's much, much better if you've got to go through that stage. Do it, as I always say. If you do, you decide to marry and settle down, you can still read. You've got long nights when you're not able to go out, but you can read. You can practice meditation. I don't think you'll get very far, but you can try. You can ponder on world problems, ponder on the classics. You can fulfill your dharma. That's the important thing. Then, when the kids are set up in life, that's probably after 16 or 17 years, you can turn your attention to the path. It's much, much worse to go rushing in when you know that you're going to have to pull out. The main purpose of the ascetic, then, is to degrade the hold which external stimuli have on the one learning to control the mind. T. We are, of course, reaching towards the next seminar, on which will be on the seven rays, the origin and application of the rays, which will be held at the Regent College. And I hope those of you who want to take up the subject of the esoteric professionally will get a chance of coming along. If you can't pay, just tell us and we'll accept money later. We're all broke. Seven-ray seminar at the Regent's College. Conscious, superconscious states on the 23rd of June. Now, that's only a lecture, but it incorporates some very useful information about superconscious states in the sense of the anatomy of it. The opening of the third hour on the 30th of June. I want to thank those people who came along to the East-West Center and helped to make those evenings a success. The last of the Scandic seminars, The Meditative Way of Life, is coming up for a month from now. Where is it? Yes, okay. Sunday the 7th of July. I think you will see from the flyers that we send out that they take quite a lot of preparatory work. And if any of you have got a computer at home or accessible to it somewhere, talk to Marcus, because we have an awful lot of work to do apart from what we are doing now. There are tapes for transcribing. Once they're transcribed onto a computer, they can then be fed into a complex that we have, so that in my old age, I will be able to prepare a seminar merely by striking what headings I want on the computer. I can extract from all of my teachings particular subjects, like the subject of the dweller on the threshold, or Plato's Atlantis, or things like that. So if any of you have any time to help. Also, if you're ever going to dispose of a car, know that you're not going to get the price for it, and you've got a new one coming up. We need about, we have five cars now, which keep the whole thing on the road. We will always accept as a gift a car that you think that you're no longer able to manage. We might be able to take it on from you, and we'd be very grateful for it. Now we come to one of the rewards that comes out of treading the secret path. I've harped on the great difficulties of it. The anguish of coming very close to something fruitful in a meditation, only to be dashed aside by some pressing factor in your daily life. But there are many, many rewards from it. Not that they should come first in your mind, that that's why you're treading the path, or that's why I'm meditating. That should not be paramount. The important thing is to keep going. Many, many times in my life, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, I was faced with the kind of problems that all of you, because you're younger than I am, are going to face. being told to cling on, to hold down onto the mountain face while the whole mountain is disintegrating around you. Many great rewards. And one of the rewards is to become aware of the soul's purpose. What your inner self wants you to do with its lease of your life. Its lease of your life. Not my will be done, but thy will be done. And you must live meditative way of life. You must live it. Offer your services to the self, the higher self, the inner self. And when people ask me to give them an indication what their soul's purpose is, I very often hesitate. I hesitate not because there are no indications of what it is. The indications are always there. No one is without a soul's purpose. I hesitate because what I may have to say might switch the personality who's dealing with me either into overdrive, so that he's like a steamroller run amok, smashing everything down that he touches, or on the contrary, that it might switch the person off. Nobody likes to be given a mundane thing to do with his life. And what people don't understand is that no matter how mundane it is, that when that is done and done well, or partly done and partly done well, then you will be eligible for something else. I remember 1951 was the year of my illumination, and I was excited, I was full of plans, lots of enthusiasm, laying my life out ahead of me, going right over the top in what I could do, supposing I might be able to do. And do you know what? If I had stuck to what I wanted to do, expected to do, I would be a very disappointed man today. I have gone far, far, far past anything I ever dreamed that I would be able to do. And the worst thing in the world you can do is either to inflate yourself or to underrate yourself. The person, the one, the thing, the it who knows is the inner self. And how he smiles today when he thinks of some of the targets that I had set myself as the ultimate. Maybe even get a book published by Wises in New York. Maybe even to be able to serve the Theosophical Society and become a lecturer. And so on. You contain within you a potential within the permanent atoms, it's indicated there, and in many other places, the horoscope, which may be far, far beyond anything that you ever aspired to. On the other hand, there may be limitations there that will stop the inner self from leading you on a particular line of unfoldment or direction. The soul wants you to act in certain ways, wants to add to the enhance the situation in the world, not to ruin it, not to ruin it by enthusing you to such an extent that you're a perfect pest to everyone in the esoteric world. And I always say that because we are so ill-informed personally, each of us, as little individuals, it's much better to wait a little while longer and let the inner self reveal himself to you, what he wants of you to do, and not rush it. The planet has gone far, far beyond anything that was ever expected of it. Far beyond it. Whereas 100 years ago, the great hierarchy of beings who had this planet's care in mind looked on it as a wayward, as a delinquent, with all sorts of dreadful things likely to happen. Today, the attitude is greatly different. The beings that look down on us regard the planet's achievements with amazement. Now, who of you, who of them would ever have believed that through the application of power and a deterrent, that the threat to world peace would have been effective through that method? 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it was, oh, be careful. Use love softly, softly. Be gentle. I'm not involved in politics, but with whoever was on the other side of the concrete wall. You never heard many voices saying, use the deterrent, be effective with it. So on. And out of all that, those dreadful long years in which we worried and wrote pamphlets about the Holocaust that would come from the release of, who was to know that the whole pack of cards would come tumbling down, what, 2 years ago? Why? Because as democracies, we anchored ourselves. There's no ray that can use the ray of love, wisdom as well, so well as the first ray. When love is encased in power and the second ray rules democracy and democracy is effective, there's nothing can stand against it. But there you are. That's how it's worked out. So don't always think that you as a personality have got the best advice about where you're going, how far you can go. Frequently you are wrong. I never dreamed that the books I wrote would be able to be consumed by the public, or that they would be translated as they are now being translated into 7 languages. But there you are. That's how it is. When I have known people sometime in my work, then I become responsible in part for them, even if they lose contact with me. Once I have known them an appreciable length of time, which means that they have come into the orbit of the being who was Plato's consciousness, the Noumenikaya, then I am partly responsible. I am my brother's keeper in that respect. And the result of that is that whether they want it or not, I'm informed as to where they are in terms of whether their karma is right. In other words, are they usable because their karma is right? I have a sister a little older than I am, sweetest thing you could ever meet, lots of potential, never did anything esoteric, said she would but didn't. And she has absolutely neutral karma. She is not in debt with karma. She is at a position in this life in which her karma is neutral. You could pick her up and use her for any particular project and you wouldn't be getting yourself into trouble. On the other hand, there are people who are laden with karma. And then, when that is so, you would be unwise to jeopardize some planetary project like an astrological dictionary involving yourself with such people. And you can't tell them that. Listen, you're karmically cursed. Don't you come near me. You must use all gently. The middle path. And you learn these things because you have been in association with them and they are your brothers and they are going to tread the path someday, even if they haven't started yet. You have to be sure, if you're going to be involved with them, that the personality is receptive. Many people have two appearances on the outside, a very nice personality. But just below the surface, there is something there, some deep resentment, some karmic factor that you can't get beyond. And then it's best to leave them to God and try somebody else out. And have they got a thirst for wisdom? Remember the story I tell? The young man with his guru, and he was switched on. Whoa, was he switched on? And he said to the guru, he said, how can I have knowledge of all these things that you talk of for myself so that I can teach it in the world? How can I get it? They were sitting on the edge of a river, and the guru took hold of the young man and took him out 3 or 4 feet into the river where the water was deep. And he suddenly plunged the boy's head down below the water and held it there. And held it there for some considerable time. And then he let him go. The youth surfaced. The old man said to him as he spluttered and gasped and so on, he said, tell me, when you were down there under the water, what did you want most in the world? Sire, I wanted air. Air. I had to have air. That was what I wanted. He says, when you thirst for the wisdom, as you gasp for air below the water, you will have it. That is very true. You have to be drunk with God if you wish to have the right access to the spirit that he pours out.